heart was already trying to push through, to anchor myself to him and will him to move. If I could hurt someone, shouldn't that mean I could help them too? Get up, I begged. Get up! Get up! Get up! Get up! Get up! There was a high-pitched wail, a sound that couldn't have possibly come from a human. I forced my eyes open. Pickup truck had his rifle in one hand and the collar of Zoo's shirt in the other, and he was tugging both in the direction of the truck. I tried to scream for her, even as I felt Volkswagen's hands in my hair, yanking me up and out of the door. He let me hit the ground hard, the loose gravel cutting open my legs and palms. I rolled onto my side, trying to twist away from the PSF's reach. From under Betty, I saw flutters of yellow dropping to the road like two small birds, and heard a door slam. "Stuart, confirm Psi number 42755 spotted." Volkswagen wrenched the driver's side door open again, pulling something bright orange from his pocket. I swiped at my eyes, trying to force the double image of him I was seeing back into one. The orange device in the PSF's free hand was no bigger than a cell phone, easy enough to maneuver in front of Liam's face from where it was pressed against the minivan's steering wheel. Taking a swipe at the PSF's ankle with my hand was pointless. He was so involved with whatever it was he was doing that he didn't so much as notice. Liam! My mouth wasn't moving. It wasn't working. Liam! The orange device flashed, and a moment later, above even the wailing of the white noise, I heard Volkswagen say, "That's a positive ID on Liam Stewart." Something hot and sharp cut through the air, billowing out under Betty like a stinging cloud of sand. I felt it rub up against my bare skin and had to turn my face away from the blinding light that came next, a flash burn that erased anything and everything that stood in its way. I heard Volkswagen cuss from above me, only to be drowned out by the sound of metal screeching against metal, glass exploding so hard, so fast, that tiny shards dropped like hail onto the ground in front of me. And then it was gone. The white noise cut out sharply as something clattered to the ground and landed a short distance away. The megaphone. I stretched my arm out, hand groping for the megaphone's handle. Volkswagen was screaming something that I couldn't hear over the ringing in my ears, and I was too focused on getting the bullhorn to actually give a damn and listen. A hand wrapped around my bare ankle and tugged me back across the ground, but not before my fingers closed around the handle. "Get up, you piece of—" There was a digital squeak, like an alarm, and the man immediately dropped my leg. "This is Larson, requesting immediate backup." I pushed myself up on my knees with a grunt, then my feet. The man had his back turned to me 1 second too long, and when he finally realized his mistake and looked over his shoulder, he was rewarded with a face full of metal as I swung the megaphone. His radio clattered to the asphalt, and I kicked it out of his reach. Both of his hands went up, trying to shield his face from another hit, but I wasn't going to go easy on him. I wasn't going to let him take me back to Thurmond. My hand closed over his exposed forearm, and I yanked it, forcing him to look down at me. I watched his pupils shrink in his hazel eyes before blowing back out to their normal size. The man had a foot of height on me, but you never would have known by the way he dropped to his knees in front of me. He hadn't even been able to catch his breath, let alone keep me from walking straight into his mind. "Leave," I tried to say. My jaw was clenched, the muscles there seized as though the white noise was still running through them like a current of pulsing electricity. "Leave." I had never done this before, and there was no way to know if it would actually work, but what did I have to lose now? His memories flooded over me, wave after wave lapping at my brain, and all I could think was, "I'm going to do this. It is going to work." Martin had said that he pushed feelings into people, but my abilities didn't work that way, and they never had. I only saw images. I could only muddle, sort, and erase images. But I'd never tried to do anything else. I had never wanted to, before this moment. Because if I couldn't help these kids, if I couldn't save them, then what good was I? What point did I even have? Do it. Just do it. I imagined the man picking up his radio. Every detail, from the way he would fumble for it without his glasses, to the way his jeans would wrinkle. I imagined him canceling the request for backup. I imagined him walking down the rocky hill that kissed the edge of the road, into the wild. And when I released my fingers from his arm, one by one, that's exactly what he did. He walked away, and each step brought a new jolt of shock. I had done that. Me. I turned to where black smoke spilled out over the road, coating the hill's grass and hidden edges in a thick, ugly blanket. Then I remembered. Zoo. I could see the wreckage clearly now as I limped forward. The pickup truck, which at one point had been parked beside Betty, was now several hundred feet away, resting in the empty green field. The smaller silver Volkswagen was on its side in front of it, a heap of twisted metal that I barely recognized. It was smoking wildly, belching out thick smoke, as if it were only one small spark away from exploding. It rammed it, I realized. The truck rammed it out of the way. I followed the trail of tire marks and glass, but I only found truck driver. What was left of him? His body was tangled up in itself in the wild grass. I couldn't tell where one limb began and the other ended. None of them seemed to be in the right place. His elbows stuck up from the ground like two broken wings. He had been rammed, too. Something cold and brittle wrapped itself around my chest, forcing me back out of the haze of smoke once I confirmed Zoo wasn't in either car. I waited until I cleared the heaviest of the smoke, before falling to my knees and throwing up what little food I had in my stomach. It was only when I looked up that I finally saw her, sitting on the road, just beside Betty, her back slumped forward, her head bowed, but alive, alive and safe. My mind clung to those two words as I tried calling for her again. Zoo looked up, panting. As I stumbled closer, the smoke revealed her in pieces, bloodshot eyes, a cut on her forehead, tears streaming down her dirt-stained cheeks. My head throbbed in time with my heartbeat as I knelt down in front of her, and for several agonizing seconds, it was all that I could hear.
"Okay?" I asked, my mouth feeling like mush.
Her teeth chattered as she nodded.
"What happened?"
I squeezed out. Zoo curled down on herself like she was trying to vanish from my sight. Her yellow gloves were beside her on the ground, and her bare hands were still up and facing forward, as if she had only touched the truck a second before. I didn't know what to say to get her to calm down. I didn't even know how to calm myself down. This girl, this yellow, she'd destroyed two vehicles and one life in a matter of seconds. And by the looks of it, she'd done it with a single touch. But even knowing that, she was still Zoo. And those hands, they were the ones that had pulled me to safety. I lifted her back into Betty with shaking arms. Zoo was hot, well past the point of feeling feverish. Dropping her into the closest seat, I pressed my hands against her cheeks, but her eyes couldn't focus on me. I was about to roll the door shut when she grabbed my wrist and pointed toward her gloves on the ground. "Got 'em," I said. I tossed them to her and then turned to confront a heavier load. Chubbs was still passed out in the passenger seat, his body hanging out of the open door. The truck driver hadn't been able to maneuver his long limbs farther than that, thank God. Otherwise, Chubbs probably would have been in the grass with the driver. His limp sack of bones smacked against the door as I slammed it shut behind him. I tripped over the tips of my tennis shoes as I made my way around the front of the van. With a cloud of bright spots bleaching out my sight, I pulled the driver's door open the rest of the way. Liam was also still out cold, and no amount of shaking was able to stir him up into consciousness. Zoo began to whimper, her cries muffled as she pressed her face against her knees. "You're okay, Zoo," I said. "We're all okay.
We're gonna be fine. I untangled Liam's arms from the gray seatbelt and half-pushed, half-rolled him off the driver's seat. I wasn't strong enough to deposit him into one of the back seats, not right then. So he ended up on the floor, wedged between the two front seats. With his face turned up toward me, I could see the muscles around his mouth twitch, every so often turning the corners of his lips up in an unnatural smile. I stared at the wheel, trying to bring to mind the right steps to getting the van to work, trying to remember what Liam had done, what Kate had done, what my father used to do. 16, and I couldn't even figure out where the goddamn parking brake was, let alone if it was actually on. In the end, it didn't matter. I could drive with it on or off, apparently, and all I really needed to know was that the right pedal was go and the left was stop, and there really wasn't a whole lot more to it than that. Betty tore through the thickest heart of the smoke and chased it down the open road until we were finally free of the wreckage, and the air coming through the vents no longer carried the echo of the white noise into our heads or the smell of smoke into our lungs. 11. I got maybe 10 miles before the boys began to rouse, with Zoo still crying in the back seat and me having no idea where we had been headed in the first place. To say I was relieved was an understatement. "Holy crap," Liam croaked. He pressed a hand against the side of his head and startled, sitting straight up. "Holy crap." His face had been inches away from Chubb's feet, so his hands went there first, yanking at them like he was making sure they were still attached to something. Chubbs let out a low moan and said, "I think I'm going to be ill." "Zoo?" Liam crawled toward her, earning another yelp out of Chubbs as he kicked his leg. "Zoo, did you?" She only cried harder, burying her face in her gloves. "Oh my God, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, I... Liam sounded agonized, like his guts were being torn straight out of him. I watched him press his fist against his mouth, heard him try to clear his throat, but he couldn't get another word out. "Zoo," I said, sounding strangely calm to my own ears, "listen to me. You saved us. We wouldn't have made it without you." Liam's head jerked around, as if just remembering I was there. I winced, but how could I be upset that he would check on his real friends first? I felt his eyes on the back of my neck as he worked his way back up to me. When he reached the driver's seat, he collapsed into it, his face drawn and pale. "Are you all right?" he asked, his voice rough. "What happened? How did you get us out?" "It was Zoo," I began, already well aware of the narrow line I'd have to walk between the truth and what I could actually tell them, both for myself and for Zoo's sake. I wasn't sure how much she actually remembered from what happened, but I wasn't about to confirm any of her fears. In the end, all I said was, "She sent one car crashing into the other. It knocked one of the guys out and sent the other one running." "What was..." Chubbs was having a hard time breathing. "That horrible noise." I stared at him, my mouth trying to push the words past my disbelief. "You've never heard that before?" The boys both shook their heads. "Jesus," Liam said. "That was like hearing a cat go through a blender while being electrocuted." "You really didn't have white noise. Calm control?" I demanded, surprised by the anger licking at my heart. "What camp had these kids been in? Candyland?" "And you did?" Liam shook his head, probably trying to clear the ringing. "They used it at Thurman to disable us," I explained, "when there were outbursts or problems. Keeps you from being able to think long enough to use your abilities." "Why are you all right?" Chubbs wheezed, half suspicious, half jealous. That was the question of the day, wasn't it? My long, sordid history with the white noise included several episodes of fainting, vomiting, and memory loss, not to mention my most recent experience with bleeding profusely out of my eyes and nose. I guess once you'd had a taste of the worst, pretty bad isn't all that terrible.
If it was their first time dealing with it, that would at least explain why they wilted like dead grass after only a few seconds. Liam was searching my face, and I wondered what he was seeing. All of it? I thought of how his jacket had felt against my cheek, the curve of his spine, and something calm and warm settled in my chest. "I'm used to it, I guess," I said, "and greens aren't as affected as blues and the others." I remembered to add this, a truth and a lie. Liam offered to trade seats as soon as his face lost that familiar pinched look, and a healthy color began to return to his cheeks. The kid deserved a round of applause for how well he was hiding the tremors in his hands and legs from the others, but I had a trained eye. I recognized the nasty afterbites of the white noise as the old friends they were. He needed a few more minutes. "Come on," he said as the dashboard clock clicked off another minute. "You've done..." His voice trailed off. I looked down at him only to realize he was looking at me, or, more accurately, my bony, busted knees. A moment later, after I returned my gaze to the road, I felt something warm hovering just above my leg and jerked away. "Ah, sorry," Liam whispered, pulling his hand back. I watched the tips of his ears go a bright cherry red. "It's just, you're all cut up. Please, can we stop for a second? We should regroup, figure out where we are." But I didn't want to just pull over alongside some random stretch of fence and pasture. I waited until we had found an old rest stop, complete with its brick-red colonial-style finish, and turned the van off the road and into the deserted parking lot. Chubbs took the opportunity to try to empty the contents of his stomach onto the ground, but accomplished little more than some enthusiastic dry heaving. Liam stood and patted his back. "Will you help Ruby when you're done?" Chubbs might have hated me, or wanted to scare me off, but he at least recognized I had played some small part in saving his skin. He didn't say yes, though, only crossed his arms over his chest and blew out a long, martyred sigh. "Thanks," Liam said. "You're the best, Mother Teresa." He went out the sliding door behind my seat and made a beeline for the small cluster of silver water fountains that stood between him and the restroom entrances. Zoo followed him out, bounding across the distance with a pink duffel bag in hand. By the time I turned my attention back to him, Chubbs had collected himself enough to start poking and prodding me. "Easy," I gasped when his finger brushed my elbow. He jabbed a finger against one of the overhead lights, and it snapped on at his command. I finally saw that the skin from my elbow down to my wrist had been rubbed raw by the road. "Turn toward me." Chubbs looked like he was fighting with all the strength he had left in him not to roll his eyes at me. "Now, green, before I grow a beard." I twisted myself around so my legs were facing toward him in the passenger seat. Unsurprisingly, they looked just about as pretty as my arm did. Both knees were skinned and already scabbing over in places, but aside from a few stray scratches and bruises that had nothing to do with the attack, they were in much better shape than my hands. Chubbs pulled what looked like a briefcase out from under his seat and popped the clasps on it open. I was only able to sneak a quick glance inside before he pulled out four white square packets and shut it again. "God, how did you even manage to do this?" he muttered as he ripped the first one open. I smelled the antiseptic and tried to squirm away. Chubbs glowered at me from over the rims of his glasses. "If you're going to make yourself at home, could you at least try to take better care of yourself? It's hard enough as it is to keep the other two in one piece without you flinging yourself at danger, too." "I didn't fling," I began, then thought better of it. "Sorry?"
"Yeah. Well," he huffed, "not as sorry as you'll be if any of these cuts get infected."
He brought my right hand up close to his face in order to get a better look, and I tried not to wince as he began to swipe at it with one of the disinfecting wipes, about as tenderly as a wolf shredding apart its dinner. The sting that followed snapped me out of the hazy, numb stupor I was falling into. Suddenly aware of his touch, I wrenched my hand away from his and took the cold, wet cloth from his hand. It didn't hurt any less when I cleaned the small bits of asphalt out myself.
You should go check on Lee and Zhu, I said.
No, because then they'll be all pissed off I'm not taking care of you.
After a moment, he admitted, somewhat reluctantly,
Besides, you did seem to... Well, you're worse off than the rest of us, at least. They can wait.
He must have seen the corner of my mouth twitch because he added,
But don't think you're going to get all the bandages. These are superficial wounds at best.
Yes, sir, I said, tossing the disinfectant wipe out of the window. He handed me a new one for my other palm, eyes still narrowed, but maybe, just maybe, softening at the edges. I felt myself relax a bit, but I wasn't suffering under any delusion that we were about to start braiding friendship bracelets for each other.
Why did you lie?
My head shot up at his question, suddenly feeling very light. I didn't... What are you... I'm not...
About Zhu?
He glanced back over his shoulder. His voice was quiet when he continued.
You said she only knocked that guy out. But that wasn't the case, was it? He was killed.
I nodded. She didn't mean to.
Obviously not, he said sharply. I was wondering why no one was coming after us, and I got worried, knowing what it would do to her. And, well, I guess you have some common sense after all.
It came to me then as I looked at him, one of those rare, perfect crystallizations of understanding. He wanted me out because he saw me as a threat to them. He wouldn't ever trust me until I proved myself otherwise, and after my slip in messing up the color of the SUV, that was likely to be half past never.
What's the world with one less skip tracer anyway?
He bent down to retrieve his briefcase again, replacing the unused supplies in it. That's right, I thought, sitting up straighter. I didn't tell them. They weren't skip tracers. They were PSFs. At that, Chubbs actually barked out a laugh.
And I'm guessing their uniforms were stuffed under their plaid shirts and jeans.
One of them was wearing a badge, I said, and the orange device they were using, I saw one at Thurmond once. Chubbs didn't look convinced, but we didn't have the time, and I certainly did not have the energy, to be running circles around the truth for the next hour. Look, I continued, you don't have to believe me, but you should know that one of them radioed in a PSI number, 42755. That's Liam, right? I gave the story from my end and left the rest for him to fill in from his side. By the time I got to a description of the orange device, he had heard quite enough. He sucked in a deep breath, his lips drawing together to a point until he looked more ferret than human. I held my own breath as he rolled down his window and proceeded to relate, down to the exact words, what I had just finished telling him, like he didn't trust me to do it myself.
I told you the PSFs would catch up to us, he kept repeating, like we hadn't heard him shout it the first 10 times. We're just lucky it wasn't her.
I wondered who he meant, but knew better than to ask. Liam ignored him and kept his back to us, still bent over the silver drinking fountain. Zhu stood next to him, dutifully holding the button down so he could use both hands to scrub his face in the stream of water shooting out of it. I used the last of the wipes to clean the dirt off my own face. I just want to know how that PSF recognized him, even before he used his orange thing. It flashed, but he knew the number off the top of his head. He didn't need to wait for it to tell him that. Chubb stared at me a moment, then brought a hand up to pinch the bridge of his nose.
Everyone had their photo taken when they were processed, didn't you?
I nodded. So they put together a network for searching the photos? I asked.
Green, how the hell am I supposed to know that?
He said.
Describe it to me again.
The orange gadget must have been some sort of a camera or scanner. That was the only explanation I could drum up that Chubbs didn't shoot down as being moronic. I pressed my hands against my eyes, trying to fight back the urge to vomit.
It's bad news if that's all it takes for them to ID us,
Chubbs said, rubbing a hand over his forehead and smoothing out the wrinkles there.
If we weren't already screwed, They probably know we're looking for East River now.
Which means they're going to have more patrols out, which means they're going to be watching our families even closer, which means it'll be even harder for the slip kid. He never finished his train of thought. He didn't have to. I let out a humorless laugh.
Come on, they're going to send out a whole armada for a few freaks?
First of all, armadas are comprised of ships, Chubb said. And second, no, they wouldn't send one out for a few freaks.
Then what's the...
But they would send one out to get Lee. He didn't wait for me to piece it together.
Green, who do you think was the mastermind behind our camp's breakout?
When the others were ready to return to the minivan, we played a silent game of musical chairs. Chubbs took the middle seat on the passenger side, and Zoo her usual perch behind the driver's seat. I had two options at that point. Crawl into the rear seat or tough it out in the front seat while trying to act like everything was all hunky-dory and pretending that Chubbs hadn't just told me Liam was responsible for what might have been the only successful camp breakout ever. In the end, exhaustion won out. I managed to collapse into the passenger seat, feeling about as lovely as a wilted head of lettuce, just as Liam climbed into the driver's seat. He grinned.
Must be tiring being the big hero.
I waved him off, trying to quiet the small, ridiculous buzz of happiness in my chest that came with his words. He was just trying to be nice.
Good thing we had the ladies there to take care of business, he continued, turning to Chubbs. Otherwise, you and I would be rolling around in the bed of a truck halfway back to Ohio.
Chubbs only grunted, his coloring still faintly gray. Liam looked a little better, at least. His face was tinged pink from the shock of cold fountain water, and his fingers still seemed to be twitching every so often. But his eyes had lost that cloudy, unfocused look, considering it was his first time being ear-tased by the white noise. Liam had recovered fast.
All right, team, he said slowly. Time for a Betty vote.
No, Chubb startled back to life. I know exactly where you're going with this, and I know I'm going to be overruled, and I...
All those in favor of letting our girl Wonder stay with us for the time being, raise your hand.
Both Liam and Zoo raised their hands immediately. Zoo looked at me with a smile that seemed particularly bright next to Chubb's glowering face.
We don't know anything about her.
Hell, we don't know that what she has told us is even true, he objected.
She could be a psychopath who kills us in our sleep, or calls her league buddies in just when we let our guard down.
Gee, thanks, I said dryly, half flattered he thought I was capable of that level of scheming.
The longer she stays with us, he added, the more likely it is the League will catch up to us, and you know what they do to their kids.
They won't catch up with us, Liam said. We took care of that already. If we stay together, we'll be fine.
No. No, 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 Chubb said. I want to register my nay vote, even though the two of you always win.
Well, don't be a bad sport about it, Liam said. This is democracy in action.
Are you sure? I asked.
Of course I am, Liam said. What I wasn't okay with was the thought of dropping you off at some back-of-beyond Greyhound station with no money, no papers, and no way of knowing for sure you got where you're going safe and sound.
There it was again, that smile. I pressed my hand against my chest, trying to keep things at bay, locked inside, to keep my hand from reaching out to brush the one he had put on the armrest of my seat. It seemed so sick, so wrong, but all I wanted to do was slip inside his mind and see what he was thinking, why he was looking at me like that. You really are a monster, I thought, pressing a fist tight against my stomach. I wanted to protect him. At that moment, it was suddenly clear to me exactly what I wanted. To protect them, all of them. They had saved me. They had saved my life and hadn't expected a single thing in return. If the showdown with the undercover PSFs had shown me anything, it was that they needed someone like me. I could help them, protect them. I didn't think I could ever begin to repay them for taking me in and letting me stay as long as I had. But if I could control myself long enough, it would be a start. It was the best I could do with what I had.
Where are you trying to go anyway?
Liam tried to keep his voice casual, but his eyes had darkened, obviously troubled.
Could you even get there on a bus if you tried?
I told them the feeble plan I'd half-baked inside of the gas station. I fingered the ends of my long, tangled hair and was surprised to feel some of the tightness in my chest ease up long enough for me to take a deep breath.
What's in Virginia Beach?
My grandmother, I think, I said. I hope. Yes, Grams, I reminded myself. Grams was still an option. She remembered me, didn't she? If I could help them find the slip kid, and if he could help me, then wasn't there a real chance I could see her again, live with her?
It was a lot of ifs. If we found the slip kid, if he was an orange, if he could help me figure out how to control my abilities, if he could help us contact our families. Once I had tapped into the vein of doubts, the rest came flooding in.
What if Grams, the thought was crushing, had passed away? She was 70 when I was taken, which meant she'd be inching closer to 80. I had never even considered it a possibility because I couldn't remember a time that she didn't look glowing and ready to take on the world, with little more than her silver hair, a neon fanny pack, and matching visor. But if I wasn't the same person I had been 6 years ago, how could I expect her to be? If she was alive, how could I ask her to take care of her freak granddaughter, protect me and hide me, when there was a chance she couldn't take care of herself? It was too much to think about now, too much to consider and agonize over in a logical way. My brain was still thrumming from the effects of the white noise, but my weak heart made the choice easy for me. All right, I said. I'll stay. And hope that none of us regret it. The deep wrinkle that had appeared between Liam's brows eased, but didn't disappear. I knew he was studying me, his light eyes flicking over my face, trying to figure out, maybe, why I had hesitated so long to agree. Whatever conclusion he came to made him sit back with a sigh and adjust the mirrors in silence. Liam had the kind of face that you could read and instantly know what he was thinking. It made it easy to trust that whatever he was saying was true. But there was a practiced quality to his expression now, an intense concentration to keep his face blank. It looked unnatural on someone who seemed to always have a grin tucked in the corner of his mouth. I leaned back, trying to ignore the throbbing in my head and the pitiful dying animal noises coming from Chubbs once he remembered how much pain he was in. Liam silently passed him a half-empty water bottle from under the driver's seat. I glanced back at Zoo out of the corner of my eye, but the twilight had lulled her to sleep. A thin sheen of sweat coated her forehead and the skin above her lips. The car rumbled back to life. Liam exhaled as he cut a diagonal path through the parking lot. He didn't seem to know which direction to turn when we finally found the road. "Where are we going?" I asked. He was silent for a moment, scratching his chin.
"We're still headed to Virginia, if I can find it.
I think we crossed the state line a while back, but I don't know where we landed. Not too familiar with this area, to be honest."
"Use the damn map," Chubbs groused behind him.
"I can figure it out without it," Liam insisted. He kept swiveling his head back and forth, like he expected someone to appear and guide him in the right direction with road flares and fanfare. 5 minutes later, the map was spread out over the steering wheel, and Chubbs was gloating in the back seat. I leaned over the armrest, trying to make sense of the pastel colors and crisscrossing lines on the flimsy, ripped paper. Liam pointed out the boundaries of West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina.
"I think we're about here."
He pointed to a tiny dot that was surrounded by a rainbow of crisscrossed lines.
"I don't suppose Black Betty has GPS, I asked.
Liam blew out a sigh, patting the steering wheel. He had decided we were going right.
"Black Betty may drive the straight and true path, But souped up, she is not.
I told you we should have taken that Ford SUV, Chubb said.
That piece of... Liam caught himself. That box on wheels was a death trap, not to mention its transmission was shot to hell.
So, naturally, the next choice was a minivan?
Yep. She called to me from the parking lot of abandoned cars. The sun was shining through her windows like a beacon of hope.
Chubbs groaned. Why are you so weird?
Because my weird has to be able to cancel out your weird, Lady Crossstitch.
At least what I do is considered an art form, Chubbs said.
Yes, in ye old medieval Europe, you would have been quite the catch. Anyway, I cut in, now in full possession of the map, we have to be close to Winchester. I pointed to a dot on the western end of Virginia.
What makes you say that?
Liam began. Are you from this area? Because if I'm not, I just remember driving past Kaiser and Romney while the two of you were out. And with all the Civil War trail signs, we should be near one of the battlefields.
Those are some good detective skills, Nancy Drew. But unfortunately, those signs pretty much mean nothing in this part of the country, Liam said.
You can barely go 50 feet without hitting a historical marker for the place this army crossed, or that guy died, or where James Madison lived.
That's in Orange, I interrupted. We're nowhere near that.
The soft blue light of evening gathered around his blonde hair, stripping it of color. He studied me for a minute, scratching his chin again.
So you are from Virginia, then?
I'm not, he held up a hand.
Please, no one outside of this state gives a crap about where James Madison's house is.
I sat back, walked right into that one. It was my mom's fault. As a high school history teacher, it had been her personal mission to cart Dad and me around to every major historical site in the area. So while my friends got to have pool parties and sleepovers, I got to walk around one battlefield after another, posing for pictures with cannons and colonial reenactors. Fun times. Made even more fun by the thousands of bug bites and peeling sunburns I always showed up with on the first day of school. I still had scars from Antietam.
Liam smiled at the dark road, keeping the minivan's headlights off. I thought it was fairly brave, or stupid, considering the Commonwealth of Virginia had never considered it a priority to install lights on its highways and roads.
I think we should stop for the night, Chubb said.
Are you going to find a park?
Relax, buddy, I got this, Liam said.
You keep saying that, Chubbs muttered, sitting back. And then it's, oh, sorry, team, let's huddle together for warmth, while the bears try to break in and eat our food.
Yeah, sorry about that, Liam said. But hey, what's life without a little adversity?
That had to have been the fakest attempt at optimism since my fourth grade teacher tried reasoning that we were better off without the dead kids in our class because it'd mean more turns on the playground swings for the rest of us. I lost track of their conversation after that. It wasn't that I had no interest in hearing all about the bizarre traditions and habits they'd managed to form in the 2 weeks since escaping their camp. I was exhausted with trying to figure out why, exactly, those two were able to cling to the thin thread that bound their friendship together. Eventually, Liam found Highway 81, and Chubbs found a shallow, restless sleep. The endless stream of old trees, only a few fully dressed for spring, passed by my window. We were going too fast, and we were too far into twilight for me to make out the patchwork of leaves that had grown in. Wherever we were, there were still traces of the dead leaves from the fall before staining the highway cement, almost as though we were the first car to drive the road in quite some time. I leaned my forehead against the cool glass, reaching over to point the AC vent directly at my face. My headache was still there, pinching the space behind my eyes. The freezing air would help me keep awake and, if nothing else, alert enough to catch my mind blindly groping for Liam's.
You okay?
He was trying to watch both the road and me. In the dark, I couldn't do much else besides make out the curve of his nose and lips. A part of me was glad I couldn't see the bruises and cuts there. It had only been a few days,
a blink in my collective 16 years of life, but I didn't need to see his face to know soft concern would be there. Liam was a great many things, but mysterious and unpredictable weren't included in that deck of cards. "Are you okay?" I countered. The car was quiet enough for me to hear his fingers drumming on the steering wheel. "Just need to sleep it off, I think." Then, after a moment, he added, "Did they really use that on you at Thurmond? A lot?" "Not a lot, but enough." I couldn't tell him that, though, without fanning the flames of his pity. "Do you think the PSF's figured out where you're going?" I asked instead. "Maybe. We could have just been at the wrong place at the wrong time." Chubbs woke behind us with a loud yawn.
"Not likely," he said sleepily.
"Even if they weren't intentionally tracking us, I'm sure they are now. They were probably forced to memorize your ugly mug and psi number. We already know you're a tasty treat for the skip tracers."
"Thank you, Mr. Sunshine and Smiles," Liam gritted out.
"For what it's worth, the guy seemed surprised that it was actually you," I said. "But who is this person you keep talking about? The woman?"
"Lady Jane," Liam said, as if that explained everything.
"Excuse me?"
"It's what we call one of the more persistent skip tracers," he continued.
"First, it's what you call her," Chubb said. "And second, persistent? Try, she's been on us like a shadow ever since we got out of Caledonia. She shows up everywhere, at any time. Like she can guess what we're going to do before we do it."
"The lady is good at what she does," Liam confirmed.
"Can you please not compliment the person trying to drag our asses back to camp?"
"Why do you call her Lady Jane?" I asked. Liam shrugged. "She's a rare British lass in a crop of bloodthirsty Americans."
"How did that happen?" I asked. "I thought they closed all the borders."
Liam opened his mouth to answer, but Chubbs got there first.
"I don't know, Green. Why don't you hit her up for a chat and tea next time she comes around to capture us?"
I rolled my eyes. "Maybe I will if you tell me what she looks like."
"Dark hair up in a bun, glasses," Liam began.
"Long, sort of hooked nose," I finished.
"You've seen her?"
"In Marlington. She was the one driving the red truck, but..."
Kate and Rob had taken care of that. She had been left behind.
"Well, she wasn't there this time," I finished. "Maybe we lost her for real."
"Fat chance," Chubbs grumbled. "The woman is a Terminator."
We passed one run-down motel after another, some occupied more than others. I sat up in my seat when Liam turned into an old Comfort Inn's parking lot, only to immediately back out of it with a low whistle. There were no cars in the parking lot, but a dozen or more men and women were hanging around outside of their rooms, smoking, talking, fighting.
"We saw this a lot driving through Ohio," he explained without me having to prompt him.
"After people lost their houses, they'd go to the nearest closed hotel and try to fight over the rooms there. Gangs and all that crap." The motel he settled on was a Howard Johnson Express, one with a quarter of its parking lot filled with different makes and models of cars, and the blue vacancy sign on. I held my breath as he navigated around the outer ring of rooms, careful to avoid driving past the office. He picked a spot at the very edge of the lot, surveying the line of rooms in front of us. Two were easily ruled out. We could see the glow of the TV through the windows and curtains, but the others weren't as obviously occupied. "Wait here a sec," he said, unbuckling his seatbelt. "I'm going to scope out the area, make sure it's safe." And it was just like before. He didn't bother to wait for any of us to protest. He just jumped out of the car, glanced into each room he passed, and began to jimmy the door of his choosing. Chubbs and I were left to divide up the last of the food we had gathered from the gas station in Marlington. Our inventory was down to a bag of Cheetos, peanut butter crackers, some Twizzlers, and a snack pack of Oreos, plus the candy I had managed to stuff into my backpack.
It was every six-year-old's dream feast. We worked silently, avoiding each other's gaze like champions. Chubbs's fingers were quick and nimble as he opened the peanut butter crackers and started in on them. The same ratty book was on his lap, the pages open and smiling up at him. I knew he couldn't actually be reading them, not with eyesight as bad as his, at least. But when he finally decided to talk to me, he didn't so much as glance up from it.
"Enjoying our life of crime yet? The general seems to think you're a natural."
I reached over to wake Zoo, ignoring whatever it was he was trying to imply. I was too exhausted to deal with him, and, frankly, none of the comebacks warring at the tip of my tongue at the moment were likely to win him over. Before I could step out of the van, my backpack and food in hand, Chubb's hand reached out and slammed the door shut again. In the dim light of the hotel, he looked, not angry, exactly, but certainly not friendly either.
"I have something to say to you."
"You've already said quite a bit, thanks." He waited until I had looked back at him over my shoulder before continuing.
"I'm not going to pretend like you didn't help us today, or that you didn't spend years living in a glorified shithole, but I'm telling you now. Use tonight to think seriously about your decision to stay, and if you decide to slip out in the middle of the night, know that you probably made the right choice."
I reached again for the door, but he wasn't finished.
"I know you're hiding something. I know you haven't been completely honest. And if you think for some insane reason that we can protect you, think again. We'll be lucky to make it out of this mess alive without whatever crisis you are bringing to the table."
I felt my stomach clench, but kept my face neutral. If he was hoping to read some clue in my face, he was going to be disappointed. I'd spent the better part of the last 6 years schooling my expression into perfect innocence under the threat of guns. Whatever he suspected couldn't have been the truth, though. Otherwise, he wouldn't be giving me one last chance to duck and run. He would have personally punted me out of the van, preferably at a high speed in the middle of a deserted highway. Chubbs rubbed a thumb across his lower lip.
"I think," he started. "I hope you get to Virginia Beach. I really do. But..."
He pulled the glasses off his face and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"This is ridiculous. I'm sorry. Just think about what I said. Make the right choice."
Liam began waving at us from the door of the room, keeping it propped open with his foot. Zoo put a hand on Chubb's shoulder. He jumped, blinking in surprise at the touch of yellow rubber. She had been so silent, I had forgotten she was there, too.
"Come on, Suzume," Chubb said, dropping a hand on her shoulder. "Maybe if we're lucky, the general will deign to let us take showers. And maybe if we're really lucky, he'll actually take one himself."
Zoo followed him out the side door, casting an anxious look my way. I waved her off with a forced smile and reached in the back seat for my black backpack. I didn't notice it until I was already outside, the darkening sky sapping away the last bit of the van's warmth from my skin. One of my hands reached out to hold the sliding door open as I leaned back into the minivan and pulled the book out of the passenger seat's back pouch. It was the first and only time I had seen it free from Chubb's hands. The flat, empty M&M's bag he was using as a bookmark was still in place. I flipped the book open to that page and didn't need to look at the spine to know instantly what book it was. Watership Down by Richard Adams. No wonder he had gone to such great lengths to hide what he was reading. The story of a bunch of rabbits trying to make their way in the world? Liam would have a field day. But I loved that book, and apparently Chubbs did too. It was the same old edition my dad used to read to me before bed, the one I used to steal from his study and put on my shelf for when I couldn't sleep at night. How had it come to me, just when I needed it the most? My eyes drank in each word, worshipping their shape until my lips started forming them, and I was reading aloud for everyone and no one to hear. "All the world will be your enemy, prince with 1,000 enemies, and whenever they catch you, they will kill you. But first, they must catch you, digger, listener, runner, prince with a swift warning.
be cunning and full of tricks, and your people shall never be destroyed. I wondered if Chubbs knew how the story ended. 12. The hot water was enough to make me forget I was standing in an old motel shower, washing my hair with shampoo that reeked of fake lavender. In the entire compact bathroom, there were only 6 things: the sink, the toilet, the towel, the shower, its curtain, and me. I was the last one in. By the time I finally walked through the motel room door, Zoo had already been in and out, and Chubbs had just barricaded himself in the bathroom, where he spent the next hour scrubbing himself and all of his clothing until they stank of stale soap. It seemed pointless to me to try to do laundry in a sink with hand soap, but there was no bathtub or laundry detergent for him to use. The rest of us just sat back and tuned out his impassioned speech on the importance of good hygiene. "You're next," Liam had said, turning to me. "Just make sure you wipe down everything when you're done." I caught the towel he threw to me. "What about you?" "I'll take one in the morning." With the bathroom door shut and locked behind me, I dropped my backpack on the toilet seat cover and went to work sorting through its contents. I pulled out the clothes they had given me and dumped them on the floor. Something silky and red spilled out on top of the pile, causing me to jump back in alarm. It took several moments of suspicious inspection to figure out what it was. The bright red dress from the trailer's closet. "Zoo," I thought, passing a tired hand over my face. "She must have grabbed it when I wasn't looking." I poked at it with a toe, nose wrinkling at its faint scent of stale cigarette smoke. It looked like it was going to be a size too large for me, not to mention the somewhat icky feeling that came with knowing where it had been. But clearly, she had wanted me to have it, and wearing it, loath as I was to admit it, was smarter than running around in my camp uniform. I could do this for Zoo. If it made her happy, it'd be worth the discomfort. There was no shampoo, but the Children's League had thought to give me deodorant, a bright green toothbrush, a pack of tissues, some tampons, and hand sanitizer, all travel-sized and zipped up tight in a plastic bag. Under that was a small hairbrush and water bottle, and there, at the very bottom of the bag, was another panic button. It must have been there the entire time, and I just hadn't realized it. I'd thrown the first one Kate had given me away, leaving it behind in the mud and brush. The thought that this one had been in my bag all this time, the entire time, made my skin crawl. Why hadn't I thoroughly searched the bag before now? I picked it up between 2 fingers and dropped it into the sink like it had been a piece of hot coal. My hand was on the faucet ready to drown the stupid thing in water and fry it for good, but something stopped me. I'm not sure how long I stared down at it before I picked it up again and held it toward the light, trying to see if I could peer inside of the black outer shell. I looked for a red blinking light that would tell me if it was recording. I held it up to my ear, listening for any kind of whirring or beeping that would tell me if it was activated. If it was on, or if it really was a tracker, wouldn't they have caught up to us by now? Was it so bad to keep it? Just in case something happened again and I couldn't help the others? Wouldn't being with the League be better than being thrown back into Thurmond? Being killed? Wasn't anything better than that? When I put the panic button back in the pocket of the backpack, it wasn't for me. If Kate had seen me, she would have smiled, and the thought only made me angry all over again. I couldn't believe in my own ability to protect these kids. Stepping under the shower's perfect warm spray was already surreal enough without having to hear the click, 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 beep of Thurmond's automatic timer to keep my wash time under 3 minutes. It was a good thing, too, since the dirt seemed to come off me in slow layers. A good 15 minutes of scrubbing, and it felt like I had turned every inch of my skin inside out. I even tried using the bubblegum pink razor that had been included in the hotel's small pack of soap and shampoo, opening up old and new scabs on my shins and knees. 16 years old, I thought, and this is the first time I've been able to shave my legs. It was stupid. So stupid. I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't care. I was old enough. No one was going to stop me. My mom always came back to me in flashes. Sometimes I'd hear her voice, just a word or two. Other times I'd have a memory so real it was like reliving the moment altogether. And now, as I kept at it, all I could think of was that conversation we'd had about this very thing, and her smile as she repeated over and over again, "Maybe when you're 13. Eventually, I washed the razor off and threw it in the direction of my bag. I didn't think anyone else would want to use it now. With blood running down my legs, I turned my attention to the nest on my head. My hair was still too tangled for me to run my hands through it. I had to work through it knot by knot, using more of the shampoo than I had ever meant to, and by the time I was finished, I was crying. I'm 16. I don't know what brought it out. One minute I was fine, and the next it felt like my chest had collapsed in on itself. I tried to take in a deep breath, but the air was too hot. My hands found the wall's white tile first, a second before the rest of my body collapsed against it. I sat down on the rough, fake stone floor of the shower and pressed my hands to my chest, grateful for the noise of the running water and overhead vent, which hid the sound of me breaking into pieces. I didn't want them to hear me like this, especially not Zoo. It was stupid. So stupid. I was 16. So what? So what I hadn't seen my parents in 6 years? So what I might never see them again? It's not like they remembered me anyway. I should have been happy that it was over, that I was out of that place. But inside or out, I was alone, and I was beginning to wonder if I always had been, if I always would be. The water pressure wavered, its temperature spiking as someone in the next room over flushed the toilet. It didn't matter, I could barely feel it blasting against my back. My fingers went to my bleeding knees and pressed down, but I couldn't feel that either. Kate had told me that I needed to divide my life into 3 acts and close the first 2 behind me. But how did someone do that? How were you just supposed to forget? There was a knock on the door, faint, almost tentative at first, but more insistent when I didn't answer right away. "Ruby?" I heard Liam's voice call. "You okay?" I took a deep breath and reached back, hand feeling through the air for the faucet. The water overhead faded to a mere drizzle, and then a drip, and then nothing at all. "Can you, open the door? Just for a sec?" He sounded nervous enough to make me nervous. For one terrifying split second, I thought something had happened. I reached for the towel and wrapped it around myself. My fingers flicked the lock over and were turning the doorknob before my brain caught up. A blast of icy air was the first thing to hit me. Liam's wide eyes were the second. The pair of big white socks in his hand, the third. He glanced around the bathroom over my shoulder, his mouth pressed in a grim line. The motel room was darker than it had been when I first walked in. We must have been well into night now. So I couldn't be sure, not in any real way, but I thought I caught a hint of color flooding the tips of his ears. "Is everything all right?" I whispered. He stared at me, letting the warm fog from the bathroom wash over him. "Liam!" The socks were thrust in my direction. I looked down at them and then up at him, hoping I didn't look as flabbergasted as I felt. "Just wanted to give you these," he said, giving them a little shake. He thrust them again in my direction. "You know, for you." "Don't you need them?" I asked. "I have a couple extra pairs and you have none, right?" He looked like he was in some kind of pain now. "Seriously, please, just take them. Chubb says your extremities or whatever are the first things to get cold, so you need them, and..." "Oh my God, Green," I heard Chubb say from somewhere in the room, "just take the damn socks and put the kid out of his misery." Liam didn't wait for me to hold out a hand. He reached past me and deposited them on the counter right next to the sink. Thanks, I said. "Great. I mean, no problem." Liam turned to walk away, only to turn back again, as if thinking of something else. "Okay. Great. Cool. Well,
So you...
Use your words, Lee, Chubbs called. Some of us are trying to get some sleep.
Oh, right. Sleep.
Liam made a vague motion toward the room's bed. You and Zoo are going to share. I hope you don't mind.
Of course not, I said.
Okay.
Great.
He put an abnormally bright smile on his face. I wondered what he was waiting for me to do or say. If this was one of those moments that being trapped in a cabin with dozens of girls for 6 years had failed to prepare me for, it was like we were speaking in two different languages.
Yeah. Great, I repeated, more confused now than ever.
That seemed to do the trick, though. Liam turned and walked away without another word. I picked up my new socks from the counter, examining them. Just before I shut the door, I heard Chubb's voice, tinged with his usual told-you-so.
Hope you're pleased with yourself, he was saying. You should have just left her alone. She was fine.
But I hadn't been, and somehow Liam had known. It took me several long moments to realize it was Zoo's dream. She and I were on the room's queen-size bed, huddled together for warmth. The boys were on the floor with the blankets, using extra towels stolen from a cleaning cart as pillows. The collective brain trust of Chubbs and Liam hadn't been able to figure out how to turn down the air conditioning unit, which insisted on spitting out its frosty breath every time the room so much as dared to spike to 60 degrees. I had been hovering around the sweet, milky edges of sleep for hours when I felt the itch at the back of my mind. There was a part of me that had been expecting it. Even though my body had settled onto the bed like a slab of concrete, my brain was still buzzing around in circles, processing what had happened with the PSFs, wondering if I could do what I had done to that man again, when Zoo's bare feet brushed against mine, and that was all it took. I was pulled into her dream head first. I was Zoo, and Zoo was in a small bed, staring up at the underbelly of a brown mattress. Darkness blurred around us until finally some recognizable shapes emerged. Stacks of bunk beds, a chalkboard, bright blue cabinets that stretched from floor to ceiling, large windows boarded up with plywood, and strange square discolorations on the wall, where posters must have once hung. I couldn't tear away. That was the dangerous thing about the dreams, how quickly you became tangled in it all. People naturally let their guard down when they slept, so much so that sometimes, if the dream was frightening enough, I didn't even need a touch to be drawn into it. I couldn't smell the smoke, but I saw it right away, gliding beneath the old classroom's door like spilled milk racing across the ground. A moment later, I jolted up, rolling until I was off the bed completely. I watched in slow, dawning horror as a dozen girls jumped down from their bunks and gathered in a buzzing huddle at the center of the room. One girl, who must have been a good head taller and 4 years older than the others, tried to get them to crouch in a line beneath the windows, with no success. Her arms were waving through the air, the long sleeves of her simple mustard-yellow uniform blurring. And then the alarms went off and the door at the far end of the room swung open. The sound the bell made was nearly as excruciating as the white noise, its pitch stretched and distorted by the dream. I was jostled forward as the other little girls made a break for the door. It didn't seem to matter to them that the smoke was suffocating or that it didn't have a visible source. In the place of neat, orderly lines was mass chaos. Kids with green, navy, and yellow uniforms spilled out into the white-tiled hallway. The emergency lights were on, fire alarms flashing red and yellow along the wall. I was thrown into the crushing river of bodies, all headed in the same direction, the direction of the smoke. My vision blurred with tears and forced the breath out of my chest. One glance over my shoulder was enough to see some of the older kids, both boys and girls, dragging out the blue cabinets from their room and knocking them over in front of the silver double doors at the other end of the hallway. We weren't evacuating at all. We were escaping. My vision was swimming in black by the time we were pushed through the other set of doors and into the cramped stairway. The smoke was thickest there, rising not from shimmering flames, but two small black canisters,
The kind PSFs kept hooked on their belts, waiting to be thrown into a crowd of unruly kids.
So the PSFs set them off?
No, that wasn't possible. It was much more likely a few kids had nabbed them, to get the alarms going and the doors open. That was probably the extent of their emergency protocol. We were trapped in that stairwell, our bodies pressed against everyone else's in one shivering mass of nerves and exhilaration. I tried to keep my eyes forward and feel for the steps under my feet, but it was hard not to see what the darkness and flashing lights were doing to the other kids. Some were crying hysterically, some looked on the verge of passing out, but some were laughing. Laughing like it was a game. I don't know how I spotted the other small Asian girl under the tide of hands and heads. She was wedged in the bottom left corner of the stairwell landing, standing on her toes, her green uniform barely visible. Her hair was gleaming black under the emergency lights, and her arm was above her head, outstretched. Toward me? The minute I made eye contact with her, her face lit up in recognition. I saw her mouth form Zhu's name. I tried to reach out, to grab her hand, but the swarm of people around me pushed me down, jostling forward. By the time I turned around, she had disappeared too. I didn't see one PSF or camp controller, not until we were at the base of the stairwell, stepping over, but mostly on, the three prone black figures on the ground. Their faces were swollen into bruised masks, blood collected on the ground under them. Someone, probably a Blue, had ripped the doors from their hinges and sent them flying outside into what looked like a wasteland of white snow. The ground was unnaturally bright under the moonless sky, partly from the dream, partly from the searchlights that switched on as the pitch of the alarm changed from a trill to a warning siren. Once we were out those final doors, we were running. The snow was knee-deep, and most of the kids weren't wearing anything beyond their paper-thin uniforms. Most of them hadn't even remembered to put on their shoes. Tiny flakes floated into the deep intersecting lines of footprints, and for a moment I felt myself slow, watching the way the snow was neither flying nor falling, just hovering there like a held breath, lighting up like a thousand fireflies under the camp searchlights. And then the spell was broken, shattered with the first gunshot. And then it was bullets flying over us, not snow. The screams ripped, jagged and piercing, from the throats of hundreds of kids. 5, 10, 15, it was impossible to count the kids that suddenly pitched forward, falling face first into the snow, screaming and howling in pain. A nightmarish red began to creep through the snow like spilled ink spreading, expanding, devouring. I reached up to my cheek, to the wetness there, and when I pulled my hand away, my brain finally connected that I had run straight through a spray of blood. I was covered in it. Someone else's blood was dripping down my cheeks and off my chin. We ran harder, faster, toward the back right corner of the chain-link fence surrounding the old school. I threw a look back over my shoulder to the brick school building, to the dozens of black figures on top of its gray slate roof, to the dozens more pouring out from the first-story windows and doors. When I turned back, the field in front of me was covered in heaps of every color, yellow, blue, green, and red. So, so much red. They formed lines, unwilling barriers that others had to jump over to keep going. I fell forward, barely catching myself on the snow. Something, someone had caught my ankle. A green girl on her stomach crawling toward me, her eyes open, her mouth gulping at the air. "Help me!" she was sobbing, blood bubbling up over her lips. "Help me!" But I got back up and ran. There was a gate at this edge of the camp. I could see it now that I was within a few hundred feet of it. What I couldn't see was what was causing the backup of kids, why we weren't dashing through the gate to get to freedom. With a jolt, I realized there were almost three times as many kids down in the snow behind me than there were in front of me. The cluster of kids surged forward with a unified wail, hundreds of hands straining forward. My size made it easy for me to slip through legs and fight my way up to the front,
where three older boys in blue uniforms were struggling to keep the crowd of kids back from both the gate itself and the one-man watch booth beside it, which was currently playing host to three people, an unconscious PSF, Liam, and Chubbs. I was so shocked at the sight of them I nearly missed the blur of green that was a little kid rushing for the fence. He darted around the teenagers in his path and threw himself against the bright yellow bars holding the gate firmly in place. He had only just touched it when all of the hair on his head seemed to stand on end and a burst of light flashed under his fingers. Instead of releasing it, his hand only seemed to clamp down harder, frozen in place as thousands of volts of electricity sent his body into a frenzied fit of shuddering. Oh my God! The gate was still on. Liam and Chubbs were trying to turn it off. I felt my own scream bubble up in my throat when he collapsed to the ground, finally still. Liam yelled something from the booth that I couldn't hear, not above the screams from the kids around me. The sight of that boy burst the temporary bubble of calm in a heartbeat. The PSFs were closer now. They had to be, because when they started firing again, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. Each layer of kids fell down and away, peeling back to reveal a new, fresh layer for the kill. I couldn't see the snow beneath them anymore. Kids turned and bolted in every direction, some heading back toward the school, others following the edges of the electrified fence, looking for another way out. I heard dogs bark and the growling of engines. Combined, the noises sounded like a monster straight out of hell. I turned to look at the trail the animals and snowmobiles were blazing toward us when something hard slammed into me from behind, throwing me into the thick snow. I'm shot, I thought, half in shock. No, that wasn't right. The blow had come from an elbow to the back of the head. The blue girl hadn't even seen me as she turned and ran back toward the camp. I rolled over just in time to see her with her hands in the air, a clear surrender, and still, they shot her. She shrieked in pain and crumbled to the ground. It wasn't just the girl who hadn't spotted me in the snow. No one did. I felt my arm stinging with the cold strain as I tried to push myself up and out of its freezing touch, but every time I made progress, another foot came slamming down across my shoulders and back. I had enough time to cover my head, but that was it. There was no getting air to my chest. I was screaming, and no one could hear. Rage and despair ripped through me. The crush of stampeding kids pushed me deeper and deeper into the snow, and I kept thinking, can you drown like this? Can you suffocate in the freezing dark? Would it be better to die this way? Hands reached around my waist. Freezing air flooded my lungs in a single painful gasp as I was lifted up and out of the snow. The gate was open now, and the kids who had been steady and calm enough to remain, who had been lucky enough not to be hit, poured through, running for the dense cluster of trees ahead. There couldn't have been more than 20. Of the hundreds of kids who had flooded through the halls of the old school, 20. I felt warm, impossibly warm. The arms holding me tightened. When I looked up, it was into Liam's bright eyes. Hang on tight, okay? Zu woke with a gasp, coming up from her nightmare for a long drag of air. I was thrown out of the dream, sent hurtling back into the freezing hotel room. Through the topsy-turvy vertigo that slammed into me, I turned toward Zu, my eyes adjusting just enough to make out her silhouette. When I reached for her, I found someone else's hands already there. Liam shook his head, trying to snap himself out of sleep's lingering grasp. Zu, he whispered. Hey, Zu. I stayed perfectly still. Hey, Liam said gently. You're okay. It was just a bad dream. My gut twisted when I realized she was crying. I heard a scraping sound, wood against wood, like he had taken something out of the nightstand. Write it down. Liam said, don't force yourself. It must have been the hotel stationery. I shut my eyes, waiting for him to switch on the cheap nightstand lamp, but he kept to his rule.
No lights outside the bathroom.
What are you sorry for? He whispered. The only one that needs beauty sleep is Chubbs. She let out a shaky laugh, but her body was still tense next to mine.
Was it the same one as before?
The bed dipped as Liam sat down.
A little different? He repeated after a moment.
Yeah?
The silence stretched a little longer this time. I wasn't sure she was still scribbling in the darkness until Liam cleared his throat and said in a rough voice,
I could never forget that.
I was really worried you had tried to touch the gate before Chubbs figured out how to switch it off. And then, so soft that I might have imagined it, he said,
I'm so sorry.
The guilt and misery that coated the words were like a kick to the chest. I felt myself shift forward on the bed, drawn to the pain there, desperate to reassure him that what had happened there in the snowy field hadn't been his fault. It scared me, knowing how well I understood him in that moment. But I couldn't. This was a private conversation, just like her memory had been private. Why was I always trespassing into places I didn't belong?
Chubbs isn't the only one that thinks it's too dangerous.
But I think Ruby's tough enough to make it without us if she wants to.
Why?
More scribbling. The only thing Chubbs wants is for us to be safe, he said, still whispering. Sometimes that gets in the way of him doing what's good for others. Seeing the big picture, you know? It's only been 2 weeks since we got out. You got to give him more time.
He sounded so confident then that I felt a small part of me give. I believed him.
Oh, man. I could practically see him running a hand through his hair. Never be ashamed of what you can do. You hear me? If you hadn't been there, we wouldn't be here. The room settled back into a peaceful quiet, save for Chubb's wheezing snores.
You feeling better?
He asked. Need anything from Betty? She must have shaken her head because I felt the bed shift again as Liam stood.
I'll be right here. Just wake me up if you change your mind, okay?
I didn't hear him say goodnight, but instead of lying down, I saw him sit, back flush against the bed, watching the door and anything that might come through it. A few hours later, with the moon still visible in the gray-blue morning sky, I gently untangled Zoo's fingers from the front of my dress and slipped out of the bed. The red glow of the alarm clock on the nightstand burned the time into my mind. 5:03 a.m. Leaving time. None of us had really unpacked our things, on Liam's insistence, but I had to collect my toothbrush and toothpaste from where I had left them next to Chubbs's in the bathroom. There was one set of Hojo toiletries left out by the sink next to the world's ugliest coffee maker. I stuffed them into my bag, along with one of the smaller hand towels. Outside, it was only a few degrees warmer than it had been in the room. Typical bipolar Virginia spring weather. It must have rained the night before, too. A feathery white fog threaded through the cars and nearby trees. The minivan, which last night had been parked on the far end of the lot, was now stationed directly in front of the hotel room. If I hadn't walked right by Black Betty, running my hand against her bruised side, I don't think I would have seen Liam at all. He was kneeling beside the sliding door, slowly scraping off the last of the Betty Jean cleaning sign with his car keys. At his feet was the Ohio plate that had, at one point, been screwed into place. My feet drifted to a stop a few feet short of him. There were dark circles under his eyes. His face was drawn in thought, his mouth set in a grim line that didn't suit him at all. With his damp hair combed back and his face clean-shaven, he could have looked a good 2 or 3 years younger than he had the day before, but his eyes told a different story. My shoes scuffed the loose asphalt, catching Liam's attention. He started to rise.
What's wrong?
Huh?
You're up early, he explained. I usually have to drag Chubbs into the shower and blast him with cold water to get him going.
I shrugged. Still on Thurman's schedule, I guess. He rose to his feet slowly, wiping his hands on the front of his jeans. The way his eyes flicked toward me made me think he wanted to say something, but instead, he only gave me a small smile. The Ohio license plate was tossed into the back seat, and in its place was a West Virginia plate. I didn't have a chance to ask where it had come from. I dropped my backpack at my feet and leaned against the minivan's door. Liam disappeared around the back of the car, reappearing a few minutes later with a red gas can and a chewed-up black hose in hand. With my eyes closed and ear pressed against the cool glass, I soaked up the honeyed sing-song radio commercial for a local grocery store. When the broadcaster came back on, it was with a grim forecast of whatever was left of Wall Street. The woman read the stock report like a eulogy. I forced my eyes open, letting them fall where Liam had been standing only a second before. "Liam?" I called before I could stop myself. "Over here," came the immediate reply. With a quick glance to the row of aquamarine motel doors, I shuffled around the back of the van until I was a few feet behind him. I stood on my toes, leaning to the right to get a better look at what he was doing to the silver SUV parked next to the van. Liam worked silently, his light eyes focused on the task at hand. One end of the hose was shoved deep into the belly of the SUV's gas tank. He looped the excess length of the unruly hose around his shoulder and let the other end fall in the red can. "What are you doing?" I didn't bother to hide my shock. His free hand hovered over the length of the hose, gliding it back in our direction. It was almost like he was tugging in a line, or at least motioning someone forward. A few drops of pungent liquid began to drip from the free end of the hose. "Siphoning gas," I realized. I'd heard about people doing this during the last gas shortage, but I'd never actually seen it done before. The liquid began to fill the can in a smooth pour, filling the space between us with a sharp odor. "Gas crisis," he said with an unapologetic shrug. "Times are a little desperate, and we were running on fumes for a while yesterday." "You're blue, right?" I said, nodding toward the hand guiding the gas into our red can. "Could you just move Betty along without it?" "Yeah, but not for long." Liam sounded shy. When he pressed his lips together, they turned an unnatural shade of white and highlighted a small scar at the right corner. When I realized I was staring, I squatted down beside him, more to hide my embarrassment than actually help. Stealing gas was, surprisingly, not all that complicated. "I guess I'm just impressed that you can use your abilities at all." A part of me wondered, then, if I hadn't had it backward this entire time. The way things were at Thurmond, the camp controllers were so vigilant about making sure that we were terrified of getting caught using our abilities, and we were made to understand from the beginning that what we were and what we could do was dangerous and unnatural. Mistakes and accidents were not excuses, and punishment was not avoidable. There was to be no curious testing, no stabbing at limits to see if there was a way to push through them. If Liam was so accomplished with his abilities, it probably meant he had taken years to practice, most of those spent outside of camp walls. It never occurred to me to think that other kids, safe at home, hiding out, that the others, who had never seen the inside of a cabin, experienced the grave and still nothing that was life at camp, might have managed to teach themselves amazing things. They weren't afraid of themselves. They weren't crippled by the weight of what they didn't know. I had the strangest feeling, like I had lost something without ever really having it in the first place, that I wasn't what I once was, and wasn't at all what I was meant to be. The sensation made me feel hollow down to my bones. "The whole thing's pretty straightforward for us blues," Liam explained. "You look at something, concentrate hard enough to imagine that object moving from point A to point B, and it just does," he said. "I bet a lot of the blues at Thurmond figured out how to use their abilities. They just chose not to. Maybe something to do with that noise." "You're probably right." I hadn't had enough interaction with the blue kids to know. Liam jerked the hose back and forth as the stream of gas slowed to a measly drip. I glanced up, searching the parking lot and motel doors for signs of life, and didn't settle back down until I was sure we were alone. "Did you teach yourself?" I asked, testing my theory. He glanced my way.
Yeah, I went into camp pretty late and had plenty of time alone, bored out of my mind, to figure things out. Naturally, the next question was, were you in hiding? But I wouldn't be able to ask that without him asking about my history and how I was caught. This had to stop. My hands were shaking like he had just told me he was about to strangle the life out of me. Nothing he had done up until now had proven him to be anything other than nice. Hadn't he shown me, time and time again, that he was willing to be my friend if I was willing to let him? It had been so long since I'd even wanted a friend that I wasn't sure I even remembered how to go about making one. In first grade, it had been stupidly simple. Our teacher had told us to write down our favorite animal on a sheet of paper, and then we had to go around the room until we found someone with a matching animal. Because making friends was supposed to be that easy, apparently. Finding someone else who liked elephants. "I like this song," I blurted out. Jim Morrison's voice was soft and barely reached us from where it was filtering through Betty's speakers.
"Yeah? The Doors?"
Liam's face lit up. "Come on, baby, light my fire," he crooned in a low voice, trying to match Morrison's. "Try to set the night on fire." I laughed. "I like it when he sings it." Liam clutched his chest like I had wounded him, but his recovery was quick. The radio DJ announced the next song. It was like Liam had won the lottery.
"Now this is what I'm talking about.
The Allman Brothers?" My eyebrows were inching up my face. Funny, I had pegged him for a Zeppelin fan.
"This is the music of my soul," he said, nodding his head in time with the music.
"Have you ever actually listened to the lyrics?" I asked, feeling the anxiety lift off my shoulders. My voice was growing steadier with each word. "Was your father a gambler down in Georgia that wound up on the wrong end of a gun? Were you born in the back seat of a Greyhound bus?"
"Hey now," he said, reaching over to flick my hair. "I said it was the music of my soul, not my life.
For information, my stepdad is a mechanic down in North Carolina and, as far as I know, still alive and well. But I was born in the backseat of a bus."
"You're joking."
I honestly couldn't tell.
"Am not. It made the newspapers and everything. I was the miracle bus boy for the first 3 years of my life. And now I'm
trying to make a living and doing the best I can," I finished. He laughed, the tips of his ears tinged with a faint pink. The song went on, filling the air between us with its rapid pulse and relentless guitars. Every piece fit together effortlessly. Not quite country and not quite rock and roll. Just warm, fast, southern. I liked it even better when Liam started singing along. When the flow of gas had stopped, he carefully pulled the hose free and replaced the gas cap. Before he stood, Liam knocked his shoulder into mine. "Where in the world did you get that dress?" I snorted, picking at the skirt.
"Present from zoo."
"You look like you want to throw it into a fire."
"I can't promise there won't be an unfortunate accident later on," I said very seriously.
When he laughed again, it felt like a small victory.
"Well, Green, it was nice of you to put it on," Liam said. "Though, be careful. Zoo's so starved for girl time that she might turn you into her own personal dress-up doll."
"Kids these days," I said. "Think the whole world belongs to them." He grinned.
"Kids these days."
We moved from car to car, working our way down the parking lot. He didn't ask for my help, and I didn't ask him any more questions. We could have stayed together in that comfortable silence for hours, and it still wouldn't have been enough for me. 13. Chubbs and Zoo were not happy to be woken up at 5:30 a.m., and even less enthusiastic about Liam forcing them to make the bed while we freshened up the bathroom and replaced the used towels. Not exactly clean of us, but it was better than alerting the management they had hosted a bunch of squatters for the night. Chubbs took one look at me as he marched out to the minivan and stopped dead in his tracks. He wore his thought plain as day on his face.
"You're still here."
I shrugged. "Deal with it." He shook his head and let out another one of his sighs. Once we were settled, Zoo and Chubbs in the middle seats,
We all watched as Liam closed the hotel room door, cup of crappy hotel coffee in hand. That's right, I thought, glancing at Zoo out of the corner of my eye. She had curled up on her seat and was using her gloved hands as a pillow. Didn't get much sleep, did he? Liam ran through his usual routine of checking the mirror's position, adjusting the recline of his seat, buckling himself in, and turning the keys in the ignition. But Liam's next order of business upon returning to the minivan wasn't to answer any of the number of questions Chubbs threw his way about where we were going. He waited until his friend was good and snoring before calling back to me. "Can you read a map?" The embarrassment and shame that washed through me painted my face red. "No. Sorry. Wasn't that something your dad was supposed to teach you eventually?" "No problem." Liam patted the empty passenger seat. "I'll teach you later, but for now I just need someone to watch the signs for me. Come on up to the co-pilot chair." I jerked a thumb in the direction of Chubbs. Liam only shook his head. "Are you kidding me? Yesterday he thought a mailbox was a clown." I unbuckled my seatbelt with a sigh. As I climbed over Chubbs' outstretched legs to the front, I glanced over my shoulder, my eyes going to his two small glasses. "Is his eyesight really that bad?" "Worse," Liam said. "So, right after we got the hell out of Caledonia, we broke into this house to spend the night, right? I woke up in the middle of the night hearing the most awful noise, like a cow dying or something. I followed the wailing, clutching some kid's baseball bat, thinking I was going to have to beat someone's head in for us to make a clean getaway. Then I saw what was sitting at the bottom of the drained pool." "No way," I said. "Way," he confirmed. "Hawkeye had gone out to relieve himself and had somehow missed the giant gaping hole in the ground. Twisted his ankle and couldn't climb out of the deep end." I tried so hard not to laugh, but it was impossible. The mental image was just too damn good. Liam reached over and switched on the radio, letting me choose the station. He seemed satisfied with my decision to stay with the Who. With the window down all the way, I leaned out, resting my chin on my hands. The morning air was warm, licked by the first rays of sunlight. When I looked up past the very tip-top of the wild trees, there was nothing but blue sky. A small sound, a ghost of a sigh, was released behind us. Both Liam and I turned to look at Zoo's sleeping face. "Did we wake you up last night?" he asked. "I caught a little of it," I said. "Does she have a lot of nightmares?" "In the few weeks I've known her, it's been an every other night thing. Sometimes she dreams about Caledonia, and I can talk her down, but I never know what to say about her family. I swear if I ever meet her parents, I'm going to—" His voice trailed off, but the anger coating it had given the air a palpable charge. "What did they do to her? Gave her away because they were afraid of her?" he said. "Like, me and Chubbs, our folks tried to keep us hidden, and that's why we went to the camp late. Zoo's parents actually sent her away when she short-circuited her dad's car in the middle of a freeway." "Oh, God. They sent her during the first official collection." He propped an elbow along the door panel and leaned his face against his hand. His Redskins cap hid his eyes from view. "I forgot you missed this." I waited for him to explain. "It was after most people our age had already been taken or were in hiding. The government issued a notice that any parents who didn't feel safe or capable of taking care of their kiddos could send them to school on a specific morning, and the Psi Special Forces would be there to collect them for rehabilitation. Kept it all very hush-hush to avoid upsetting the children or inciting them to misbehave." I rubbed my forehead, trying to force out the images flittering through my mind. "Did she actually tell you this?"
Tell me, you mean?
He kept his eyes straight ahead, but I saw his hands choke the wheel. "No. She wrote it out in bits and pieces. I haven't heard her say a single word since..." "Since the breakout?" I finished. I felt relieved in spite of everything I knew. "It's a choice, then, not something they did to her." "No, it has everything to do with what they did,"
And it's not a choice, Liam said. I think maybe the most frustrating feeling in the world is to have something to say but not know how to put it into words. To have lived through something but not be able to get it out of you before it festers. I mean, you're right, she can talk, and maybe one day she will. After everything I've put her through, after what happened, I just don't know. It was the most frustrating feeling in the world, second only to the inherent helplessness that came with being trapped in a camp, all of your decisions made for you. After what had happened with Sam, I didn't say a word for almost a full year. There was just no way to vocalize that kind of pain. The radio jumped as we lost the station signal, switching through a Spanish language channel, then to one with classical music, before finally settling on the dry, nasally voice of a man reading the news. To inform you that initial reports indicate that 4 separate explosions were set off this morning in Manhattan's subway. Liam's finger shot out to switch the channel, but I changed it right back. Though confirmation has been slow to come out of the city, we believe these explosions were not nuclear or biological in nature and were concentrated around Midtown, where President Gray was rumored to be in hiding after the most recent attempt on his life. League? West Coast? Or fake? Chubb's sleepy voice floated up behind us. Our sources indicate that President Gray and his cabinet believe this to be the work of the Federal Coalition. Federal Coalition? I repeated. West Coast, the boys answered together. Chubbs elaborated. Based out of Los Angeles. They're the section of the government that survived the D.C. bombings and weren't crazy about the idea of Gray disregarding that whole 2-term limit they had set up. They're mostly talking heads since the military sided with Gray, obviously. Why is Gray in New York and not Washington? I asked. They're still rebuilding the Capitol and the White House, only it's not going so well since, you know, they defaulted on all of their debt, Liam said. He spread the government out between Virginia and New York for its protection, to make sure none of the fugitive Psi groups or the League got any ideas about wiping it out all at once. So, the Federal Coalition, they're against the camps? The reform program? Chubb sighed a little. Hate to break it to you, Green, but something you'll learn pretty fast is that we're not exactly a priority to anyone right now. Everyone's more focused on the fact that the country is broke as a joke. Who do we like, then? I pressed. We like us, Liam said after a while, and that's about it. There were, apparently, only 2 restaurant chains left in the state of Virginia, or at least the western half of it, Cracker Barrel and Waffle House, and one wasn't open before 9 o'clock in the morning. Thank goodness, Liam said in a solemn voice as he parked a short distance away from the Waffle House. I don't know how we would have chosen between these 2 fine culinary establishments. He had nominated himself to order whatever food he could afford with $20, but refused when I asked if he wanted me to go with him. Zoo held up a small notebook, waving it to get his attention as he stepped outside. Done already? She nodded. Why don't you have Chubbs check your answers? No, don't make that face. He's better at math than I am anyway. You're damn right I am, Chubbs said without looking up from his book. Zoo flipped the flimsy notebook open to a blank page and scribbled something down. When she held it up for him to see, Liam grinned. Whoa, long division. I think you're getting ahead of yourself, ma'am. You still haven't conquered your double-digit multiplying. I watched him hop out of the minivan, a flare of annoyance shooting up from my core. All of this would have been so much easier if he wasn't the only one of us who looked old enough to pass for 20. At least I'd feel a lot better knowing one of us could be out there watching his back. Liam must have felt my gaze burning through the back of his jacket because he stopped and turned to wave before disappearing around the corner. You really have to stop encouraging him, Chubbs was saying to Zoo. I glanced back, watching as he used the blunt end of her pencil to follow lines of numbers on the page. He needs to accept reality at some point. Zoo's face scrunched up, twisting like a piece of hard lemon candy was stuck on her tongue. She punched him in the shoulder.
I'm sorry, he said, but clearly wasn't. It's just a waste of time and energy to teach you this stuff when you're never going to get the chance to use it.
You don't know that, I said. Flashing Zhu a reassuring smile, I added, you'll be ahead of everyone else your age by the time things go back to normal.
When had I started believing in normal anyway? Everything I had been through up to that point could only be used as support for Chubb's argument. He was right, even if I didn't want to admit it. You know what I'd be doing if things were normal? Chubb said. I'd be picking which college I was going to attend later this fall. I'd have taken my SATs, gone to football games and prom, taken chemistry.
His voice trailed off, but I picked up the frayed ends of his thought, all the same. How could I not? These were the exact things I thought about when I let myself get to that dark place of should be and could have been. My mom said once that education was a privilege not afforded to everyone. But she was wrong. It wasn't a privilege. It was our right. We had the right to a future.
Zhu sensed the shift of mood. She looked between us, lips moving silently. We needed a change of subject.
I said, crossing my arms over my chest and leaning back against the seat, like you would have ever gone to a football game.
Hey, I resent that.
Chubbs handed Zhu her notebook. Here, you need to work on your nines. When he turned back to me, it was with a disapproving look.
I can't believe you, of all people, fell for his cotton candy dreams.
What's that supposed to mean?
You were in Thurmond for what, 5 years?
6, I corrected. And you're missing the point. It's not that I believe in what Lee's saying. It's that I hope he's right. I really, really hope he's right. Because what's the alternative? We're stuck hiding out until their generation dies off? We flee to Canada?
Good luck with that, Chubb said. Both Canada and Mexico have built walls to keep us out and them in.
Because they thought IAAN was a contagious disease?
No. Because they've hated us all along and we're only looking for the right excuse to keep our fat asses and fanny packs out of their countries forever.
Liam chose that exact moment to reappear, 4 styrofoam containers balanced between his hands. He was moving fast, almost at a run. I leaned over and popped the door open for him and he all but dumped the containers on my lap.
Oh God, what now? Chubbs cried.
Whoa, I began, trying to keep the hot food from spilling all over my legs and the seat. Betty's engine started with a snarl, and suddenly we were rocketing backward. With the sheet blocking the back window, Liam had to rely on using the side mirror to navigate us down the road and up into the small back alley that divided the Waffle House from an abandoned jewelry consignment store. I braced an elbow against the door as he steered the old minivan past the dumpsters to the cramped employee parking lot, tucked away in a dead end around the corner. The minivan lurched to a stop, throwing all 4 of us forward.
We're going to stay here for a little while, he announced to our terrified faces. Don't panic, but I think I saw... I mean, it'll just be safer here for a bit.
You saw her. It wasn't a question. Chubbs already knew the answer before he asked.
Lady Jane.
Liam rubbed the back of his neck as he leaned forward. He had left the nose of the minivan out far enough so we could peer around Waffle House's wall to see down the alleyway.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
How was it possible that she had caught up with us?
Holy hell! Chubb squawked. Pretty sure or definitely sure?
After a moment, Liam answered.
Definitely sure. She's got a new set of wheels, a white truck, but I'd recognize that smug face anywhere.
Did she see you? I asked.
I don't know, he said. Probably not, otherwise she and whoever her new boy toy is would have tried to run me down. They drove by just as I was leaving.
I craned my neck forward, trying to see far enough past the wall of the restaurant to the alley opening. As if on cue, a glinting white truck rolled by, 2 dark figures in the front seats. Liam and I flew back against our seats at the exact same moment, looking at each other in alarm. I don't think either of us took a breath until we were sure no one was coming down the alley to investigate. He cleared his throat.
How about you pass out the food? I'll just check. Liam Michael Stewart.
Chubb's voice thundered from the back seat. If you step 1 foot out of this minivan, I will order Green to run you down with it.
Don't think I won't, I warned, knowing exactly what Liam wanted to do. Go out and risk his neck by walking down the alley to make sure the coast was clear.
When I handed him a styrofoam container, he slumped back in his seat, accepting defeat. Liam had ordered each of us a simple meal of scrambled eggs, bacon, and 2 pancakes without syrup. The others dug in with gusto, inhaling the meal in 5 bites. I gave my pancakes to Zoo before Liam had the chance to. After some semblance of calm had settled back over us, he pulled his map up and spread it out over the wheel. The dashboard clock beside him said 7:25 a.m., and when he turned to face us, it was with an expression of determination I had never seen someone wear so early in the morning.
"Okay, team," he began, "we need to get back on the right track. I know our last East River was a total bust, but we have to keep looking. So let's review the facts those blues gave us. Edo."
It was only after a full minute of silence that I realized that was the extent of the facts.
"We should have tried to bribe them for more information," Chubb said.
"With what?" Liam said, setting the map down. "They wouldn't take you, Chubbs, and you're our most precious commodity."
Chubbs, unsurprisingly, did not find that funny.
"Did they spell Edo out for you? Was it 1D or 2?" I asked, because if it's an actual clue, that could make a difference.
The two boys shared a look.
"Well? Crap,"
Liam said finally. I felt a sharp tug on my arm and turned toward Zoo, who was holding up her notebook for us to see. She had written the letters E-D-O.
"Nice job, Zoo," Liam said. "Good thing one of us was listening."
"And that was it?" I said.
"The only other thing they coughed up was that if we hit Raleigh, we'd gone too far south."
"And we had to beg for even that," Liam confessed. "It was really pathetic."
"They could have been pulling our legs, too," Chubb said. "That's what irritates me the most. If East River is so great, why were they leaving?"
"They were going home. Remember? The slip kid."
While they were arguing, I slipped the map out from under Liam's hands and squinted at it, trying to make sense of the lines. He had given me a very vague rundown of how to route a path from point A to point B, but it was still overwhelming.
"What are you guys thinking?" I asked. "What theory were you working with?"
"We ran across the kids right around the Ohio state line," Liam said. "They were coming from the east, headed west. If you add that to the other bit about D.C. and Raleigh, the likely candidates become West Virginia, Virginia, or Maryland."
Zoo said Edo is another name for Tokyo, but it seems a little far-fetched he'd be there.
"And I think it's a code," Chubb said, "a cipher of some kind."
He sat up a little straighter, turning to face me fully. The way the smile spread over his face made me think of a nature documentary we watched once in school, about the way crocodiles flash their teeth as they skim through the water toward their prey.
"Speaking of codes, didn't you say the league broke you out because you were a world-class codebreaker?"
"Crap.
I didn't say world-class."
"Oh, yeah!"
Liam's face lit with the most heartbreaking expression of excitement.
"Can you take a stab at it?"
"Double crap."
I guess, I said, careful to keep my face neutral. "Zoo, can I see the notebook again?"
They were all staring at me. They might as well have been sitting on my chest for how paralyzing it was. It was near freezing in the van without the heat on, but my body felt heavy with hot, sticky panic. I was holding onto that notebook like it was a prayer from heaven. I knew there were kids out there who could plug in a few dozen letters into their brain and spew out complex coordinates or immediately spot a riddle hidden in a puzzle, but I definitely was not one of them. Chubb snorted.
"Looks like the league picked a lemon."
"Hey," Liam said, his tone sharp, "we've been mulling over the damn thing for 2 weeks and have figured out exactly nothing. You can't even give her an hour to think about it."
"Could I sub out the letters E-D-O for numbers? 5, 4, 15? God, what other kinds of codes were there? A railroad code? No, that wasn't right. Or
was it not a code? That would make a hell of a lot more sense, actually. The riddle had to be something that kids both in and out of camps could figure out, and it couldn't be too difficult, otherwise no one would ever get it. Lie, I thought, reaching up to smooth a stray piece of hair back from my face. Just lie. Just do it. Just say something. What did three-digit numbers usually represent? A price, a time, an area code? Oh, if I was right. Oh, God, was more like it. Oh, Liam repeated. Oh, what? I'd forgotten. Well, I corrected myself. I could be remembering it wrong, so don't get too excited, but I think it's a Virginia area code.
There's no area code that's four digits. Chubb said, 5415 doesn't work.
But 540 does, I said. People sub out O for zero when they talk sometimes, right? Liam scratched the back of his head and looked over at Chubb's. 540? Does that sound familiar to you? I turned toward Chubb's, suddenly seeing him in a new light. You're from Virginia? He crossed his arms and looked out his window.
I'm from Northern Virginia.
Well, that figured. 540 is Western Virginia, I explained to Liam. I'm not sure how far north and south it extends, but it should be right around this area, I think. I showed him on the map. I didn't just think. I knew. 540 had been my area code when I lived with my parents in Salem. There are a number of cities and towns, but there's also a lot of undeveloped land. Not a bad place to hide out.
Is that a fact? Liam kept his eyes on the road and his voice even, but there was something maybe a little bit too casual about it.
Did you grow up near there?
I looked down at the notebook in my hands, feeling something clench in my chest.
No, I didn't.
Virginia Beach, then.
I shook my head. Not any place you've been or heard of. I heard Chubb's tongue cluck as he opened his mouth to say something, but there was a sharp cough from the driver's seat. The topic had been dropped, and no one was willing to try picking it up again, least of all me.
Well, it's as good of a lead as any, though I wish the area was a little smaller. He glanced my way. Thanks, Ruby Tuesday.
A not unpleasant warmth rushed up from my center. Don't mention it. And if I'm wrong, I let the thought trail off. It was a good lead. With one last glance down the alley to make sure it was clear, Liam refolded the map and tossed it back into the open glove box. Betty came back to life with a low growl.
Where are we going? Chubbs asked.
It's a place I know. Liam gave a one-shoulder shrug.
Some place I stayed before. The drive shouldn't take us that long. Maybe 2 hours. If I get lost, though, one of you Virginians is going to have to step up to the plate and help me out.
It had been a very long time since someone had labeled me like that. As a person with a home. It was true I had been born here, but Thurmond had been my home for nearly as long as it hadn't. Gray walls and concrete floors had bleached out almost every memory of my parents' house, stripping away first the small details, the smell of my mom's honey-soaked biscuits, the order of the pictures lining the staircase wall, before going on to devour the bigger ones, too. I used to wonder, at night when it was quiet enough in the cabin to think, when I let myself get to the point of wishing for home, if the home in my heart was supposed to be the place where I'd been born, or if it was the place that was raising me, if I got to choose it, or if it had somehow already claimed me. The truth was, when I looked at my reflection in the window, I couldn't see any bit of the Ruby that had lived in a little white house at the end of a lane, honey sticking to her fingers and hair falling from her braids, and it made me feel empty in a way. Like I had forgotten the words to my favorite song. That girl was gone forever, and all that was left was a product of the place that had taught her to fear the bright things inside of her heart. We passed exit after exit to Harrisonburg and the turnoffs for James Madison University. Driving down a major highway with nothing more than a prayer that no one would pull us over wasn't exactly my idea of a good time, but for now, the risk seemed worth it.
at least for the view. I loved the Shenandoah Valley, every inch of its gorgeous spread. When I was little, my parents used to pull me out of school early for a long weekend of hiking or camping. I never brought books or video games for the drive. I didn't need them. I would just stare out the window and drink it all in. You know in movies, the ones set in older times, when the shot freezes on the hero or heroine gazing out over the forest or river, and the sun catches the leaves at just the right slant, and the music begins to swell? That's exactly how I felt as we entered the Shenandoah Valley. It didn't hit me until that moment, until the first glimpse of the gauzy blue mist surrounding the mountains, that we really were in Western Virginia, that if we stayed on the highway, we'd be 2 hours away from my parents in Salem. 2 hours. I didn't know how to feel about that.
Ugh, Liam groaned, pointing toward the temporary road sign up ahead. 81, closed between Harrisonburg and Staunton, use local roads.
By 9 o'clock in the morning, we were finally deep enough into Harrisonburg to find its pulse of life. Here and there, we saw restaurants opening their doors to the morning light. We passed a few older adults pedaling away on their bikes, balancing precariously on two wheels with their briefcases or bags, their heads bent toward the sidewalk. They didn't even look up as we passed. No JMU students, though. None that I could spot. Chubb sighed at the sight of them, leaning his forehead against the window.
"You okay, buddy?" Liam asked. "Need to stop and smell the scholasticism?"
"What's the point?"
Chubb shook his head. "It's closed, like all of the others."
I whirled around in my seat.
"Why?"
"Lack of students, mostly. If you're old enough to go to college, you're old enough to be drafted. Even if that wasn't the case, I doubt people can really afford it anymore."
"Jesus, that's depressing," I said.
"The offer still stands," Liam told his friend. "You know, I'm happy to break into a classroom for you if you need to sit in one of those cramped seats and stare at a whiteboard for a while. I know how much you like the smell of dry erase markers."
"I appreciate that," Chubb said, folding his hands in his lap, "but it's not necessary."
We passed what I thought must have been a black wrought iron fence, but it was almost impossible to see, trapped as it was beneath what looked to be a raggedy patchwork blanket. It wasn't until we got closer that I realized what we were actually looking at. Hundreds, maybe thousands, of sheets of paper that had been tied and taped onto the fence or stuck between the thin bars. Liam slowed the car, tilting his sunglasses down to squint at them.
"What do they say?" Chubbs asked.
"I can't."
Zoo only put her head back down and shut her eyes. They were missing posters, with the faces of little kids and teenagers, photographs, signs whose wording had been smeared away by rain, the biggest of these being a banner that said nothing more than Matthew 19:14. It hung crookedly, almost like someone had tried to rip it down, only to have someone else come along and half-heartedly string it back up. The wall of faded paper took a beating as the wind blew through the fences, ripping some of the more decrepit sheets free and making others flutter like hummingbird wings. And where there was room, we saw stuffed animals and flowers and blankets and ribbons.
"No, not missing," I thought. Those kids had been taken, or really were gone forever. Their parents and families were searching for them, posting their pictures because they wanted them back. Needed them.
"God."
Liam's voice sounded strained.
"Where did they say we could pick the 81 back up again?"
The ash trees lining the lonely one-lane back road were just coming into their lovely young skin, but in the afternoon light, their shadows couldn't have been longer. 14. I slipped off into sleep somewhere between Staunton and Lexington, and woke up just in time to get a perfect view of the towering white warehouse that was Roanoke, Virginia's former Walmart. Sure, the blue sign was still clinging desperately to the side of the building, but that was about the only recognizable thing about the supercenter. A number of stray carts wandered across the parking lot aimlessly, carried this and that way depending on each moody gust of wind. With the exception of a few abandoned cars and green dumpsters, the enormous blacktop parking lot was empty.
Against the tangerine blush of the afternoon sun, it looked like the apocalypse had already touched down in Virginia. And we were only a stone's throw away from Salem. A 10-minute drive. My stomach clenched at the thought. Once again, Liam insisted on going in alone to check it out. I felt Zoo's rubber glove on my arm and didn't need to look at her face to know what kind of expression I would find there. She didn't want him charging into what looked like an honest-to-God hellhole alone any more than I did. This is why you stayed, I reminded myself, to take care of them. And in that moment, the person that needed me most was the one walking away. I jumped out of Betty, my hand gripping the door handle. Honk the horn 3 times for trouble, I said, and slid the door shut. Liam must have heard because he waited for me, leaning against one of the rusted shopping cart stalls. Any way I could convince you to go back to Betty? Nope, I said. Come on. He fell in step beside me, fists dug deep in his pockets. I couldn't see his eyes, but the way he was slouching toward the demolished doors was telling enough. You asked me before how I knew about this place, he said when we were nearly to the entrance. No. No, it's okay. I know. None of my business. Green, Liam said, it's okay. I just don't know where to begin. You know Chubbs and I were both in hiding. Well, it wasn't exactly pleasant for either of us. He at least got to go stay at his grandparents' cabin in Pennsylvania. Ah, but you had the pleasure of holing up in this fine American establishment. Among other places, Liam said. I don't like to talk about that time in front of Zoo. I don't want her to think that that's what her life is going to be. But you can't lie to her, I said. I know you don't want to scare her, but you can't pretend that her life isn't going to be hard. It's not fair. Not fair. He sucked in a sharp breath, closing his eyes. When he spoke again, his voice had returned to his usual soft tones. Never mind. Forget it. Hey, I said, taking his arm. I get it, okay? I'm on your side. But you can't act like it's going to be easy. Don't do that to her. Don't set her up to be crushed. I was in camp with thousands of kids who grew up thinking Mommy and Daddy were always going to be there for them. And they, we, are all coming out of this seriously damaged. Whoa, 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 Liam said, all traces of anger gone. You are not damaged. That I could have protested until I was blue in the face. Whoever had unhooked Walmart's glass sliding doors from their tracks hadn't done a good job of finding a safe place to store them. Shards of glass coated the cement floor, blown out dozens of feet from the black metal frames. We stepped over and through their mangled shapes, entering that small, strange space where the greeter would have been. Next to me, Liam's foot slipped against the sallow dust collected on the floor. I shot an arm out to brace him as he grunted in surprise. Even as I helped him right himself, his eyes remained fixed on the ground, where a dozen footprints fanned out in the dust. Every shape and size, from the jagged pattern of the sole of a man's hiking boot to the decorative swirly curls left behind by a young child's tennis shoe, all stamped out there like cookies cut from a fresh spread of dough. They could be old, I whispered. Liam nodded but didn't pull away from my side. I hadn't fooled either of us. The store's power had been shut off some time ago, and it was clear it had been open to the wild for too long. There was only a second between when we first heard the rattling in the nearby shelves and when Liam jumped in front of me. It's, I began, but he silenced me with a shake of his head. We watched the shelves, waiting. And when the deer, a gorgeous, sweet thing with a silky caramel coat and big black eyes, came prancing out from behind the overturned magazine racks, Liam and I looked at each other, dissolving into shaky laughter. Liam pressed his finger to his lips and waved me forward, his eyes scanning the dark fleet of identical cash registers in front of us. Someone had taken the carts from the store and tried stuffing them in the lanes, as if to create a kind of fortified wall against any unwanted visitors. Carefully, without disturbing the pile-up of plastic baskets, we climbed up and over the nearest register's conveyor belt. Standing on top of it, I could see where more shelves had been lined up in front of the other exit. It looked as though something huge had come slamming through it at one point, bursting through the makeshift barricade. What did that? I think there's some part of everyone, Sai or not, that's tuned into the memories of a place. Strong feelings, especially terror and desperation, leave an imprint on the air that echo back to whoever's unlucky enough to walk through that place again. It felt like the darkness was stroking beneath my chin with a beckoning finger, whispering to me to lean forward and know its secrets. Something terrible happened here, I thought, feeling a cold drip down my spine. The wind whistled through the broken doors, playing us the kind of screeching song that made the hair on the back of my neck stand on end. I wanted to leave. This was not a safe place. This was not a place to bring Zoo or Chubbs. So why was Liam still going forward? Overhead, the emergency lights flickered on and off, buzzing like boxes of trapped flies. Everything beneath them was cast in a sickly green light, and as he moved farther and farther down the first aisle, it seemed like the darkness waiting at the end of it would swallow him whole. I sprung forward into the sea of empty metal shelves, half of which were knocked flat on their backs or leaning against others in slanted lines, their shelves buckling under some invisible weight. My sneakers squeaked as I wove through the sea of lotions, mouthwash, and nail polish on the floor. Things that seemed so necessary in the past, so vital to life, wasted and forgotten. When I caught up to him again, my fingers closed around the soft, loose leather of his jacket's sleeve. At the slightest tug, Liam turned, his blue eyes lit up in surprise. I took a step back and pulled my hand back to my side, shocked at myself. It had felt natural to do it. I hadn't been thinking at all, only feeling a very sharp, real need to be close to him. "I think we should leave," I whispered. "Something about this place doesn't feel right." And it had nothing to do with the strange crying of the wind or the birds high up in the old store's rafters. "We're okay," he said. His back was to me, but he slipped his hand from his pocket. It drifted back toward me, floating up through the darkness. I didn't know whether he meant to motion me to move forward or for me to take it, but I couldn't bring myself to do either. We walked side by side toward the back right corner of the store. It seemed that this section of the store, with all of its hardware and light bulbs, had been left somewhat alone, or at least hadn't seemed as useful to the people who had picked the other shelves to the bone. I saw where we were headed immediately. Someone had set up their own little camp, using bright blue pool rafts as mattresses. A few empty boxes of graham crackers and Hostess cupcakes were piled on top of a cooler, and on top of that was a small wireless radio and lantern flashlight. "Wow, I can't believe this is still here." Liam stood a foot behind me, his arms crossed over his chest. I followed his gaze down to the dozens of indentations in the cracked white tile. They were almost enough to distract me from the patchwork of old bloodstains on the ground beneath his feet. My lips parted. "It's old," Liam said quickly, like that would make me feel any better. Liam reached toward me, forcing a smile. I blew out the breath I had been holding and reached up to take his hand. At almost the exact moment our hands touched, I saw it. The emergency light above that section of the back wall snapped back to full glare like a spotlight, illuminating the enormous black Psi symbol painted there, along with a very clear message: "Get out now." The thick, uneven letters looked like they were weeping. The light crackled and went back out with a loud pop, but I still threw myself forward, out of Liam's grip, straight for the spray-painted message. Because that smell? The way the words drooped? I pressed my fingers against the Psi symbol, and they came away sticky. Black. Fresh paint. Liam had only just reached me when I felt the strangest sensation of burning right at my core. I looked down, expecting to see a spark igniting the front of Zoo's ridiculous dress, and then I was falling, and Liam was falling on top of me, bulldozed right over as if we had been nothing more than two daisies poking up through the cracks in the tile. Liam's shoulder rammed into my chest, knocking the air out of our lungs. I tried to lift my head to see exactly what had happened, but there was this weight, this solid, invisible slab of stone, keeping me on my back and Liam flat against me. The floor was freezing at my back, but my entire focus was on the solid press of his shoulder against my cheek. Our hands were caught between us, and for a moment I had the uneasy sensation of not knowing where one of us began and the other ended. He swallowed hard, the pulse in his throat close enough for me to hear it. Liam moved to lift his head, straining the muscles that lined the strong column of his spine. "Hey!" he shouted. "Who's there?" The only response was another shove from the invisible hands. Suddenly we were shooting across the ground, Liam's leather jacket squealing against the dusty floor as we slid. I watched the emergency lights beyond Liam's head pass with dizzying speed, tracking together like a single beam. Riotous laughter followed us down the aisles, seeming to come from below us, above us, on either side. I thought I saw a dark shape move out of the corner of my eye, but it looked more like a monster than a person. We tore through ribbons of ripped shower curtains, the body lotion, the bleach, to the line of cash registers at the front of the store. "Cut it out!" Liam yelled. "We're..." There are some sounds you hear once and never forget. A bone breaking, an ice cream truck song, Velcro, a gun safety clicking off. "No," I thought, "not now, not here." We slid to a painful stop at the checkout lanes, the impact with the metal jarring every sense out of my body. There was a single moment of agonizing silence before the once dead store lights surged into brightness, and then the cash register flashed on, conveyor belt sputtering to life. First one lane, then the next, and the next, every single one falling to order like soldiers. The numbered signs above blinked between yellow and blue, like a dozen warning signals, faster than my eyes could follow. At first I thought it was white noise. All at once, the building's security alarms, intercom system, and televised displays went off, 100 different voices screaming at us. Block after block of ceiling lights snapped on, electricity pouring through them after years of existing as nothing more than hollow, dusty veins. Liam and I turned to see Zoo, her bare right hand splayed out against a checkout lane. Chubbs was next to her, his face ashen. After only a few seconds of Zoo's power surge, the lights on the registers began to pop like firecrackers, dropping streams of blue-white sparks and glass to the ground. She had only meant for it to be a distraction, I think, a flash and a bang to draw the attention of our attackers away from us long enough for an escape. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see her waving us toward her, but the machine under Zoo's other hand had heated to a terrifying molten glow. I felt the invisible grip on me slacken suddenly, but fear kept me still as the dead. She wasn't letting go. Liam and I must have had the same thought— the same scorching fear, because we pushed to our feet, shouting for her to stop. "Turn her off!" someone managed to shout over the alarms. "Zoo, let go!" Liam stood and stumbled over cans of sunscreen and bug spray from a nearby display. I saw him lift his arms, ready to yank Zoo away with his abilities, but Chubbs was faster. He tugged the glove off Zoo's other hand and pulled it over his own, then all but ripped her arm away from the metal. The lights went out. Just before the overhead bulbs exploded, I saw Zoo's face as she came out of whatever trance she had been locked in. Her big eyes were rimmed with red, her short black hair on end, freckles standing out against the full flush of her oval face. The sudden darkness gave Liam the opportunity to knock both her and Chubbs to the ground. And then, by some small miracle, the emergency lights flicked back on. The first sign of movement didn't come from us. I saw our attackers clearly now, climbing over the mangled heaps of white shelves. Four of them, each dressed in layers of black, each with a gun raised and ready. My first thought, as it almost always was when I saw anyone in a black uniform, was to run, to get the others and bolt. But these weren't PSFs. They weren't even grown-ups. They were kids, like us.